Let's get started. The idea of this series is to meet once a week for 45 minutes and to discuss and to learn specific tshuvos that were written and published by some of the great poskim of the last part of the 20th century. And hopefully, if we take this series farther enough, then eventually I think we'll go to some current and living poskim as well. The thought was to start with Rav Moshe Feinstein for the simple and perhaps obvious reason that there is no question that certainly among those Rabbanim who wrote formal, published, written tshuvos, he was by far the most prolific and influential. There were other poskim who were as or more prolific than him. Some of them will study. But I think it's clear, certainly in America, but really anywhere, the level of influence that he had, the level of chidush, the seriousness of the issues which he discussed is really, really unparalleled. And he had tremendous, tremendous influence. When I was talking to Avi and some of the guys last week and we decided on this format, I just, even going into Shabbos this week, was thinking about, where to start. I mean, it's overwhelming the number of topics that Rav Moshe wrote about, how significant they were, how influential they were. So I just decided before Shabbos I would pull off my shelf at home the first volume of Igros Moshe, on Or Chaim Chelek Aleph, and I was flipping through it for topics. The very first tshuva that Rav Moshe decided to include in his published yorks has to do with the size of a kippah. Some people looked at me and thought that that might be a dangerous topic. So I don't know what you're talking about, but anyway, so maybe we'll do that or not. I'm not sure how long we'll go, whether it's a month or longer. Maybe if guys are enjoying this, we can continue with tshuvas of Rav Moshe. But then I do envision, if people are interested in enjoying this format, going to other great poskim of the 20th century, whether it's the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Avadji Yosef, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and as I say, if we want, we can eventually even get to some of the living great poskim, perhaps even Yibarel Chaim. You all met last night, Rav Asher Weiss. He has three volumes of tshuvas, so there's a lot to do if we want to stay with this format. But over Shabbos, actually at the Kotel, I'll confess, in one of the moments where I couldn't hear what might have been going on closer to the actual Kotel, as I was flipping through the Igros Moshe, I thought, on discussing Rav Moshe's view on Mechitza. On the one hand, this is very much not Lamaisa. All of you, and really even me, but all of you grew up in a Jewish community, in an Orthodox community, in which Mechitza was taken for granted. It's depending on what community you're from. The height of Mechitza is not always taken for granted. The front or back versus front, side by side, one-way glass, balcony, those types of things aren't always for granted. And I understand there are outlier communities as well. But trust me when I tell you that none of you grew up in the type of Jewish community that America was when Rav Moshe was writing these tshuvas. And the very question of whether an Orthodox shul needed a mechitza was very much in question. That's simply not true anymore. Not every shul wants to be Orthodox. Shuls want to push the boundaries of Orthodox. But no one questions anymore that an Orthodox shul, by definition, needs a mechitza. That victory was won not only by Rav Moshe and Rav Soloveitchik and other great Rabbanim of the day. And in fact, there's a very famous book called, I think, Mechitza, or The Mechitza by Baruch Litwin, which was put out on that topic, and tremendous halachic, but especially historical information therein. If I'm not mistaken, I think there's either four or five tshuvas that Rav Moshe includes right back to back to back on this topic, but the one that I have on the sheet in front of you primarily is the first and by far longest of his tshuvas, and I think almost all of his main yesodos come out in this piece. Most topics, whether it's Rav Moshe or others, will probably just focus on one tshuva. In this case, the tshuva is so big that I really did cut and paste and I left out considerable amounts, and I tried to do my best to pick the things which I thought were really, really important or necessary. But whether we have time to go into it or not, but for those who are interested, just to peek to the back of the sheet, you'll see that on the bottom half of the sheet, I included one of the other tshuvos that it's also included in Rav Moshe, just because I thought it summarized and had a few perhaps focuses or nuances that may be not fully clear in the original tshuva. So we'll see how far we can get, how much time we have, but that's the agenda today, to kind of study this tshuva, not only because of its landmark significance, but also it gives an opportunity, not that there's one style, It's true. If we do enough studying of Rav Moshe, maybe we can have a sense of his overall style. But even, and that's true for any particular posek, but no matter who the posek is, and Rav Moshe, I think, is a perfect example of this, as I've spoken a lot in the Gemara Chaburas, right? You take the sugya as it comes. You can't always superimpose, you know, your methodology onto the Gemara. That's when methodology turns into dogma. So similarly with Rav Moshe, depending on the Shaila, certain cases he's starting with a Metzias, an existing Minhag, for good or for bad. Other times he's starting with a text. Certain sugyas have clear and obvious text and voluminous text which he's dealing with. And others, part of the genius is to extract, so to speak, water from the rock to find information and insight where there may not be as much information. So depending on the question and the sugya, you're going to have differences. But to some extent that we can see the way Rav Moshe would deal with a question like this, which is obviously so consequential for the entire American Orthodox community, so we get to see not only the significance of Rav Moshe and the role he played, but to some extent the methodology of how he would deal with a certain question like this. If you take a look, first just notice the date. Whenever you're doing tshuva, it's always important to notice the date because that gives you a little bit of perspective. So if right now we're in Tufshin Ayin Zion, so this is, correct me if I'm wrong, 71 years ago. Right, so again, that's what I say. When these people were asking shilas about do you need a mechitza or not, and that kind of thing, that these were the shilas that were being asked 70 years ago, and now they're all variations of things, but everyone's turning back to what Rav Moshe and Azay and others in that generation were publishing. So let's take a look at the opening paragraph where he lays out the question. Bahad she'ilna levayer inyan hamachitza she'tzarech lios bein anoshim l'noshim beis ha'knesses. Let's discuss the question that was asked to me to explain and understand the role of machitza that is necessary to divide between men and women in shul. The kamahu shir gova aliba de hilchasa. So one very important question he's going to deal with is, how high does a machitza have to be? Right, that's a very, very important question, right? In certain communities, the issue may be a machitza at all, but in many communities, and this is the part that still may be relevant nowadays, the issue is not whether to have a machitza, but how big, how obstructionist, etc., does it have to be? Mishum, says Rav Moshe in the third line, Shiesh mekomos b'medina senu zu shehitchilu lifrotz b'nina mechitza shebein hanoshim lanoshim b'beis ha'knesa shenishar lona l'mikdash ma'at. So, as I alluded to, he, in an understated way, but still very clearly, he says, because we have what he calls a new problem. People are pushing the boundaries. All of a sudden now, there's a push to have no mechitza. And again, you have to understand, if this was what the local conservative or reform shul was doing, that would be tragic to the extent that you care about the Jewish people, but people wouldn't be sending a shaila to Rav Moshe about this. This is what was people were trying to maintain Orthodox shuls without a mechitza. And this what was, of course, again, Rav Moshe and others decided to wage a strong and strenuous campaign for. The Efshar, Rav Moshe writes, he tries to be charitable in his understanding of the situation. Efshar she'ein chashudin she'avru adina ela michisar yedinas chomer ha'iser. Maybe people don't realize how serious this is. Maybe it's just a lack of knowledge. And therefore, the rabbi who's writing him is suggesting perhaps if we would just clarify what the purpose of mechitza is, what's the basis of the din, how high it has to be, if we could just get that information out more well-known and more clear, then maybe, being charitable, that people really are just sinning out of ignorance, if we can get that information out, maybe that will help people. So that's the question. So here he goes. Now, in Rav Moshe, I would say everyone, but many, many poskim, both either before or especially following Rav Moshe's lead, look to a particular sugya, a particular gemara in Maseches Sukkah, as the basis for this discussion. Maybe some of you, if you learned Sukkah, you're familiar with this particular Gemara. The Gemara is commenting on a Mishnah that discusses a tikkun gadol, a great improvement or enhancement the Chachamim made to the physical structure of the Beis HaMikdash as a result of, or in anticipation of, the Simchas Beis HaShoeva that would take place in the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishnah itself on the previous Amud mentions that there was a Tikkun Gadol that the Chachamim did on Motzi Yom Tov Rishon in anticipating of the first night of Chol HaMoed. And the Gemara is now analyzing what that Tikkun was. And Rav Moshe uses that Gemara, a short Gemara. Again, he analyzes it in tremendous depth. As much as I gave you on the sheet, it's only a fraction of the Tshuva. But Rav Moshe uses that Gemara as his ground zero, his main source, A, how he interprets the Gemara, and then uses that as his application for his understanding of Mechitza. And as we will see, and if it's not clear at some point, remind me by asking me a question. Rav Moshe ends up, as we'll see, both conceptually and especially practically, falling somewhere in the middle. There are people who disagree with Rav Moshe both conceptually about what the role of mechitza is, and there are definitely people who disagree with Rav Moshe about how high or how opaque, how big of a divide a mechitza has to be. You can find some who may be a little bit more makel than Rav Moshe, and you will definitely find posts who are more machmir than the position that Rav Moshe outlines here, sketches out here. So just keep that in the back of your mind. But let's look at the second paragraph or see where Rav Moshe gets this from. Hine etzem hadin sh'afim ha'anoshim heim b'tzad echad v'hanoshim b'tzad acher asurin helios below mechitza v'ulani esdaita dina doraisa. So Rav Moshe states, and he's going to try to prove this in a minute, his first hypothesis. Of course, it's obvious, says Rav Moshe, that if the men and women are literally sitting together, mixed pews, as it's often referred to, that's horrible, that's an Isra Doraisa. But what if you have separate seating without a mechitza? So Rav Moshe's opinion is, even that is an Isra Doraisa. Even that is an Isra Doraisa. Yes, question? Huh? Let's see. So Rav Moshe continues. Varaya misuka daf nonala from the base. Here, this is the Gemara I was alluding to. Shehiksha b'Gemara al hagzuztera sheosu be'ezras noshim b'motza yom tov harishon shalachag kedei lehoshiv hanoshim milamala v'ha'anoshim milamata. He's about to ask on this. Rav Moshe assumes a certain literacy. He doesn't always spell out everything. So he's actually quoting the middle of the Gemara. The Gemara, as I mentioned a moment ago, asks on the Lashon of the Mishnah that there was this Tikkun Gadol that the Chachamim established. What did the Chachamim do? So the Gemara explains that for the Simchat Beis HaShoeva, which took place in what was known as the Ezras Noshim of the Beis HaMikdash, which was not a place reserved exclusively for women, but it was generally the closest that women would get. And the Simchat Beis HaShoeva would take place in that area, and it used to be, the Gemara is very clear, at a later point of the Tshuva, Rav Moshe quotes that part of the Gemara, it used to be, initially, there was different stages, but initially it used to be that the women were the closest to the action, the front of the bus, if you will, the men were behind that, and then both women and men looking in the same direction would see the Chachamim, as the Mishnayos described, it was only the big Rabbanim who would dance and entertain and juggle and do jumping jacks or whatever their Rabbanim did at this, you know, juggle fire and the like at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. But the Gemara says, as Rav Moshe is going to mention, that this led to inappropriate intermingling, kalus rosh, too much levity, too much, I think at some point he says even, whether accidental or not, but physical contact, but certainly a very casual, mixed environment. And then they just strive to try to switch it and flip it. Maybe if the men are in the front and the women are behind them, that'll be better. And the Gemara says, no, it was still a problem. They still could not get a handle on the social scene that was taking place. You know, again, it's bad enough if people are acting inappropriately, you know, on Amex or something like that. But in the Beis HaMikdash, right, that's obviously a more problematic phenomenon. Until they had this Tikkun Gadol. What was the Tikkun Gadol? On the walls around this courtyard, they built these planks coming out. They became a permanent addition to the Beis HaMikdash, sticking out, and they would be there all year. And then the Rabbanim, the Chachamim, would come down in anticipation of these week, you know, this Chalamoid week of parties for Simchas Beis HaShoeva, and on these, you know, vertical, you know, or maybe not vertical, not the right word, but these planks sticking out of the wall, they would then place boards across them so that you created a balcony. So the basic, you know, underlying girders were there all year round. That they added that to the Beis HaMikdash. And then when it would be necessary, they would add the planks to create a floor for the woman to, I don't know, sit or stand, and they were now raised. It used to be that everyone was on the same level, and this was the Chiddush, the first ever women's balcony. So that's what he's referring to here. Again, let's look back inside again. We're right after the underline. So the Gemara had asked, how could the Chachamim, the Gemara explains that was the Tikkun Gadol the Mishnah was lauding the Chachamim for doing. So comes on the Gemara, and the Gemara asks, how could they do that? We're on the second paragraph there, the fifth line or sixth line. Hoksiv, hakol bichsav. This is a pasuk from Divrei Hayamim, Aleph, Perek Kaf Chet, in which the pasuk says that everything that was built in the Beis HaMikdash has to be according to the specific rules delineated, HaKol B'Chsav, in the Psukim, to the various Nevi'im or people who were in charge of building the Beis HaMikdash. You can't just decide, you know, I'm good at Shiputzim, you know, I want to get into a business of, you know, I'm going to flip houses, I want to practice a little bit, I'll add something to the Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, no, it has to be HaKol B'Chsav, you're only allowed to do things if it was written in the Pasuk, in the Navi. So if that's the case, Osir Lahosif Shum Davar Babinyan Bayis of Azara. So how could the Chachamim do this? So the Gemara answers, V'tiritz Rav Dikra Ashkehu. They found the Pasuk. Shetzarch Lahavdil Anashim Yinashim Kidapirish Rashi Ayin Shum. And this is a Pasuk that describes, very interesting Pasuk, that describes when there will be the time, again, we don't have to get into all the details now, maybe you've heard of some of these concepts or terms, when there will be Milchemes Gog Umagog. We're talking, you know, eschatology, achras hayamim, that kind of stuff. And there'll be a Mashiach ben Yosef who precedes the Mashiach ben David. And Mashiach ben Yosef will do all sorts of political or military things, but Mashiach ben Yosef will die. And it talks about his funeral, and they're going to be maspid, and at that time, do the haspedim, the eulogies. And the pasuk there, the Gemara Darshins, the pasuk there describes the men and the women being separate. And the Gemara Darshins, if even at a time of hesped, we can understand naturally, people are going to be more well-behaved when, you know, they're eulogizing somebody who passed away, right? You know, it's like, you know, really, really, you know, if you saw someone, forget halacha for a minute, if you saw someone kind of like during hespedim at a funeral, you know, hitting on a girl or trying to pick somebody up, right? I think you would think that that's really, really coarse. It's really, really just, you can't respect, I mean, it's just too base, right? So Chachamim understood that also. I said, but if even then, even at a funeral, the chamim were makbid, there should be a separation. So halachas kama v'kama in something like the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, where by nature everything is much more, you know, there's adrenaline, there's levity, there's excitement, there's fun, it's jovial. Everyone's, you know, guard is necessarily lower, and therefore the Gemara says that's the basis of this tikkun gadol. So says Moshe wants to know, again, he's commenting on language that's in the Gemara, but he's really going to make a big deal about that. What was the Isser? What would have been so bad? Your question. What would have been so bad? And for example, if you take a look, we'll just skip to the bottom of the right-hand column for a minute. You'll just see at the third to last line, he throws out a possibility. The Ein Lomar Sha'Isser Hayimidin Yichud. Maybe you'll think that what was happening is there were certain situations in which men and women were becoming secluded with each other. Right? Yichud, not the topic of our shir, but or the tshuva, but yichud is a serious halacha. Very serious halacha. Very, you know, whole section of Shulchan Aruch, Sfarim written on yichud. But Rav Moshe basically, in one breath, rejects it for the same reason that probably all you would. Why would you think that that's probably not the issue here in the Gemara? Yeah, where's the yichud, right? Yichud needs a certain amount of seclusion. And none of us, to speak for myself, are the biggest experts in exactly what the Beis HaMikdash look like. That doesn't sound like the scenario they're describing at Simchas Beis HaShoeva is a public yichud hazard. Now, I grant you, just like you could be at some public event and a person could, you know, with a girl, slip out and find a private place to violate yichud, I imagine that could happen at Simchas Beis HaShoeva too. But the Chachamim didn't mean to make a tikkun and a takana to the structure of the Beis HaMikdash, which sounds like it's something that was resolving a problem affecting hundreds or thousands of people, because it could be that two people every now and then sneak out for yichud. And anyway, this balcony probably wouldn't have helped. So says Rav Moshe, that's not the issue. So what is the issue, says Rav Moshe? If you go back to that first paragraph, the second paragraph that we were doing it, if you take a look in the middle where we were up to, about halfway down, he says, Uposhut, Shakavanas hatiritz hu, Shalachain hu, Kimifurish, Shasarach lasos hazizin, or agustra, Falhusruch leomar ze aidegara chose. It doesn't have to be by the Navi, etc., because it's so obvious, but rather, Mimela bechlal hakol bichsab. He says, the Isser that we're talking about, which he's we're going to get to in a minute again, he says, what the Gemara is saying is, it's so obvious, it's such a problematic phenomenon, that even though there's nothing in the psukim that describe the blueprints of building Beis HaMikdash that says, and build a balcony, but if there's such a serious Isser d'oraisa, we can just assume it's implicitly, it's necessarily included, because obviously, the Beis HaMikdash can't be built in a way which allows a serious Isser d'oraisa. If the issue would only be some kind of an Isser D'Rabbanon, says Rav Moshe, then I might understand why it's not written. But then, says Moshe, that wouldn't be enough of a concern to supersede the concern that, but this isn't written in the base, this isn't written in the Navi. Again, I just want to be clear. What Rav Moshe is trying to balance here is a tension. Clearly, there was a need which the Chachamim were trying to fix. There was a problem they're trying to fix. But at the same time, the Gemara itself says, but their fix, their suggested solution, is not written anywhere. And don't we have this issue that you can't do things that aren't written? So what Rav Moshe is explaining, it's really based on our Maharsha, is that what the Gemara is trying to thread the needle, is saying if you can find a problem which is so serious and so severe, then that, in a certain sense, bypasses this, quote, prohibition of hakol b'chsav. You can only build things exactly as they're written. Because even if it wasn't written, it's just obvious, right? I guess, again, this is a poor analogy, but just the easiest thing comes to mind. If I was a builder and I'm building a house and I'm building a certain bedroom, and afterwards, the couple, the homeowners come to inspect the house, and they're looking and they see this thing cordoned off with four walls and no door. And they, one second, it's nice. I know this is supposed to be, the girl's room, my son's room. But where's the door? And he says, what are you doing? Look at the plans. There's nothing for a door. Right? That wouldn't be a good defense by the contractor. Now, if he called you and said, where do you want me to put the door, on this side or that side, that might be a good defense. But you can't build a house without a door. You can't build a room without a door. It doesn't make any sense. So Rav Moshe says, if this Isser would be so obvious and so central, it must mean, the Gemara is telling us, the way you can bypass and get around this problem of Hakol Bichsav is that it must be such an obvious problem that it doesn't need to be written. It's so obvious. Yes?
Well, if it was such a double posture, why was there ever a time where there was no machitza?
So the problem, I think, so maybe let's sort of find this. The problem, the halachic problem, is so severe that we don't have to write in a bypass. It wasn't maybe my analogy. As I said it wasn't maybe the best analogy. I don't think Rav Moshe is saying that the problem, the problem of the mingling and what that led to, as a actual human phenomenon, was so obvious. Then it should have been written. But given that there is a phenomenon, a human phenomenon of people doing whatever was wrong, says Rav Moshe, you don't have to say, but can we do, our hands are tied, it wasn't written. This problem, halachically, is so severe that the Beis Medrash has to allow for us to protect against it. That's his argument. So, please. Yes, exactly. Exactly, yes. I don't know how many years the Simchat Shreva went on before this either became a problem, before the rabbis realized it was a problem. It could be the Mefarshim discussed that, I'm not aware, but it could be that no one discusses it. I'm not sure we're aware of that. But the Mishnah describes that they made this tikkun gadol, which implies clearly that it wasn't always there. Yes? Doesn't sound like it, right? In the Mishnah. I didn't double check. I didn't pay attention, honestly, when I was reading the Mishnah. It's a good hara. Anyway, so let's see. What is he talking about? So what's the bottom line here? So look at the underlying part at the end of that paragraph. El tzarach lomar shu iser midoraisa lachein hu kimifurush she tzarach lasos zizin ugustros ashlo nemra azedeh neviim b'hakol b'chsav. So again, he says, you see here that this must be a real serious iser. So what is it? So third paragraph. Umimela chazina and mea sugya de sukka. Da'afam haisa machitza aval kazu shef sharlavolide. Here's the magic words. Kalus rosh. Yesh adain hua iser de oraisa. He says the issue here is a lack of appropriate seriousness. Again, if I'm not mistaken, I think we're going to get to a paragraph later where he is more specific even about what was happening. But the category which Ramosha hangs his hat on, again, the words are in the Gemara. He didn't invent it. But what Rav Moshe really goes to town on, the term, the halachic category, he'll fill in the details, is kalus rosh. That there has to be a certain seriousness and reservedness, certainly between the sexes, in a place of Kedusha like the Beis HaMikdash. And given the environment, it was conducive not to that, but the opposite, to kalus rosh. And in fact, it was being violated. And as a result, they we're simply had to figure out to it. Let me just move a little bit forward, and then we'll take questions, okay? I want to just try to cover more ground. So he goes through here in the beginning of this paragraph the different stages, which I already told you, that initially the women were in the front, and that didn't work. Then they tried, okay, so maybe if we put the women in the back, that'll be more tzinius, and that didn't work. Aval Kev and Chutzuk, where it's underlined. Kev and Chutzuk, La'amo, Neger, Hasharim, Hapsuchim, Kaliros, Asasimcha, Rosh, Abode, Kalas, Rosh, Flohilo, Amachitzim, Kain, Haya, Dain, Isramidaraisa, Lachain Hutter, Lazos, Hagustra, Shmizer, Raya, Shumidaraisa, Kidibi, RT. Says Rav Moshe, each way they tried it, the men looking past the women towards the party, the women behind the man looking. Each one had whatever savara you would think would have prevented the problem, but says Rav Moshe, it didn't help. And you see from the Gemara is referring to this term of Kalas Rosh, that must be an Isser D'Oraisa. Again, because his point is, you can't bypass the problem of Hakol B'Chsav unless the problem is so serious that it doesn't need to have been specifically a license from the architecture psukim in the Tanakh. And that's where he rejects, again, at the end of that at the end of this column here, he rejects the possibility of Yichud. He just doesn't think that's a practical issue. And then if you go over to the left-hand column on the top, he describes, again, the various possibilities that they thought. They had a Hava, Min, and Mobile. If you put the women here, we put them in there. Each time we thought that this would be okay. And let's look at the fourth line of the game. We're on the left-hand column now, on the top paragraph, the fourth line. Sha'af mitzad ha'histaklus atzma, chazin shlo ha'isak peda, t'hazeh yadu gam mitchila. Very important point. If I were to ask you at the beginning of this chabura, what do you think the purpose of mechitza is? Right? So some of you might have said intermingling kalas rosh or something like that, but what would have been a very likely alternate model for why you would need, an alternate reason for why you need a mechitza? What would you think? Histaklus, right? Men shouldn't see women. And if you've ever been to many, you know, any Hasidic shul for sure, you know they take that very, very seriously. So that is, in fact, the position of many Hungarian poskim, prominently, although not exclusively, prominently the Satmar Rebbe, who has tshuvas very much against Rav Moshe. He's a very upsetter of Moshe. Rav Moshe is, you know, this modernish guy, and he's, you know, ridiculous. You know, it's not just about Kalas Rosh and keeping the men and women separate. It's about histaklus. Men shouldn't be able to see the women. So we're not doing the Satmar Rebbe now, nor are we doing a comprehensive treatment of mechitza. But in Rav Moshe's tshuva, he, as they say in Yiddish, he bavorns. He anticipates but rejects that argument. He says, because if the issue was histaklus, that was not something that you needed to like figure out by trial and error. Because that was just obvious before you put up this balcony so the women are out of the men's, you know, their, you know, natural, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Line of vision, line of sight. Thank you. You would have had that already. And yet apparently that wasn't the problem. You know, even especially in the beginning when the men were behind the women, they had to look past the women for sure. And yet that didn't seem to be the obvious problem. And therefore, let's just finish the paragraph, then I'll take a question. That we're talking about a situation in which women were dressed in a tzanua way and men weren't looking at places which are otherwise supposed to be covered. Right? The issue of histaklus, of a man looking in a way, I don't mean just you glance and you see someone, but you histaklus is looking to derive sexual pleasure. So there's two forms of that prohibition. This is beyond the mechitza discussion, just important Jewish knowledge. Number one is any part of her body, from her pinky to any other part of her body, if you're looking deliberately to derive that pleasure, then any part of the body, again, if we're not talking about your wife, then that's usher. And number two is there are certain parts of the body which are known as erva, which are supposed to be covered. So, says Rav Moshe, it must be the assumption was that the women are coming in a tzanua way, so the parts that are supposed to be covered are covered. That's a practical phenomenon. And we don't have to worry that even, you know, the back of her head or the pinky or even for that matter her face, men are looking in a deliberately sexually provocative way. And therefore, they weren't worried about histaklus. That apparently wasn't the issue. It was only once after a few years of trial and error they realized that the real problem was the intermingling, the levity, the kalas rosh. Kisharosh, shabom, izile de kalas rosh, shu laharbos. Here we go. Here he gives an example. Now you want a definition of it a little bit. He says, laharbos sicha b'nehem, a little too much talking. Ulenegia biadehem uchedome, which I don't know if it means deliberate or accidental, but even some level of physical contact. Hitkinu lahachli shanashem yubimachutz achreinashem. So that's when they decided, okay, let's move the woman back. And when even that didn't work, then they needed to build the balcony. Ami, you had the first question, I think.
I was
going to
ask the question.
Okay. Okay. Excellent. So let's continue. We're going to try to cover as much of this as we can. Everyone got it? We're on the. Yes, please.
The assumption here is that the Kalut Rosh is coming
was there, is there a Havamina that the Kalut Rosh was coming as a result of the Simchat Beit HaShoeva?
I think that's an excellent question. I think the answer is it's not so much an either or. That's what Rav Moshe I alluded to before. He quoted, because again, I didn't give you the whole thing here, but if you look in the Gemara when they quote the Psukim about the funeral of Mashiach ben Yosef. So the Gemara seems to acknowledge that there's no question that the type of circumstances you're in make the difference. And if you're in an environment like a Simchat Beit HaShoeva, you have to be more worried that the whole tone is much more frivolous and much more loosey-goosey, to quote an SAT word, and therefore you have to be more worried. So the answer is yes and yes. There's some kind of a sliding scale between A, your level of murav, the level of intermingling, and what the environment is, how somber and how, you know, funky and fun it is. Yes, I don't know.
Is this to prevent things that would be otherwise usher, that are specifically usher because of the context they're in?
It's a very good question. I think it's clear, according to Rav Moshe, that this would be usher anywhere. It's worse in the Beis HaMikdash. It's for sure worse than the Beis HaMikdash. But I think, you know, again, without getting into the whole broader discussion of, you know, intermingling between the sexes, but the most whatever one could find among legitimate poskim is the most liberal attitude towards chevra murev it is. We'll leave that as a blank thing. Whatever that is, kalas rosh is still usher. So, and especially when you're talking about touch, physical touching, and the like. So I think that it's exacerbated or made, it's more likely to happen because of the frivolity, and the very isser is worse because of its location. But nevertheless, it would be, I think, usser anyway. Okay? Next paragraph. Hayotze mizeh. Here we go. Now let's get tachlis. So that was, again, we spent a while, but we only did a fraction, but a while on the source. Okay, Rav Moshe is a source-based posek. There's halachic intuition, which, you know, when you're Rav Moshe having, you know, gone through Kol Tarakula, many, many times over many, many decades, your intuition is different than, you know, that intuition is different than yours or mine. But it's not just intuition. His tshuvas are source-based, rigorous. And now that we've gotten through that as his main source, again, I left out all sorts of other makoros. Yerushalmi, Yamarsha, but this is his main source. After that, says Rav Moshe, now let's bring it home. Hayotze mizeh, gam bebotek nisiyos, shemeskabtsin shama noshim venoshim lispalel, tov yoser lasos, guztura, shanoshim yelamala. And this Rav Moshe makes this point and repeats it in a number of places. Shetedu lechem, Rav Moshe's preferred mechitza was a balcony. Rav Moshe holds that is the preferable halachic form of mechitza because it is a model. Rav Moshe sees this is Gemara as the basis of mechitza, and since in the base of Mikdash that was the tikkun that they came up with, he feels that that is not only effective to avoid the problem of Kalas Rosh, although as we'll see, he'll say if you can't do that, then there may be other ways to solve the problem. But Rav Moshe is clear that that is the ideal or preferred tikkun. Third line, v'me'ezetam kosher lasos gzuztura. Whether it's you don't have the space to build up, it costs more money. I can tell you, as someone who's been involved already once and will now hopefully soon be involved a second time in building a shul, going higher up is more expensive. And it could be, I'll throw this out there just for doing it without commenting further than that. Maybe if you're in a given community where the women don't want to be on top, there could be different reasons why. I know just remember when we built the shul in Baltimore, in the end we didn't build the balcony because it was too expensive. But at the time, there were women who really thought it would be better. They can actually see more if they're on a balcony. And other women who dafka felt, no, it's worse. We feel like we're more out of the action. So that's probably, I don't know if it's 50-50, but I think in any community, I assume you'd find women, if they're being honest, who would probably reflect both of those attitudes. But says Rav Moshe, from a halachic perspective, in his opinion, the balcony is preferred. But if you can't do that for whatever reason, tshrichem la'asos mechitza mamish. Then you have to make an actual partition. Kazusha timana milavol lidei. Kalas Rosh. Again, this sounds like a big chumrah, but I'm telling you, it's a huge kula. Because what is he not saying? You don't have to build a mechitza that prevents seeing. Let alone letting the women see what's happening. That for sure is not, you don't have to do. But you don't even have to prevent build a mechitza for the men not to be able to see the women. You just have to be able to build a mechitza. Let me just get further, okay? For the men not to be able to interact in a very, you know, unhealthy or spiritually unhealthy, I should say, way. Now you might have thought, one second, once we are saying that there's an option to have women and men on the same level with the mechitza, I learn Shabbos, I learn Sukkot, what's a minimum mechitza? 10 tefachim, so I'll just build a 10 tefachim mechitza, that's a halachim mechitza. You know, good osik, good okis, it goes all the way up to Shamayim. It'll be it's a brisker mechitza, you know, all the halachic, right? It says Ramosha, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, right? There's no way, because the whole point, Azlina Basar Taima, the whole point is to prevent the Kalas Rosh. And if the mechitza is, you know, I don't know, up to my pupik, as my bubby would say, up to my belly, but if I could bear, you know, I could literally walk, I've been in a shul where you could, a guy who over 6 feet could walk over the mechitza. Right, something like that, you know, or just can easily reach over. I was once in a place where a man literally reached over and gave a little squeeze to a woman who I hope he was related to, but I'm not even sure. But even if he was related, right, Ein Kalus Rosh Gadol Mizeh, says Ramosha. You want to know to the second question. Now that we know the why, form follows function. We know the function, the purpose of the mechitza. So now we can understand how tall the mechitza should be. So said Ramosha, it can't just go by regular laws of mechitza. That's ridiculous. Well, let's skip down. Lo sagi gama mechitza shall asar tefachim in a karkash in a klum. That doesn't do anything. Linyan Kalus Rosh shem yichulim ledaber al harbo sicha em anoshim. Again, forget the squeeze. You can certainly talk over that without any impediment whatsoever. In koshi liga libidem, there's no, it doesn't in any way inhibit or prevent people from touching each other. Ve'eluchah kalas rosh gadol mizu v'nechshuv kumurav and mamish v'iser daraisa. He thinks that would be a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. So what's left for us is, so then how tall does the mechitza have to be? Point number one is, what's the purpose of the mechitza? To stop kalas rosh. Number two is, therefore, we're not going to look to the halachos in a formal sense of mechitza in Hilchos Shabbos or Sukkah. This is not relevant. We have to use a little more common sense, says Ramosha. We have to be functional and practical. What's going to solve the problem? And therefore, Ramosha says, next paragraph from this left-hand column, Mistaber l'nizdaiti, the famous sheet of Ramosha, Shesagi b'mechitza gavoha ad achar haktefayim. It has to go up to the men's shoulders. Or maybe the women's shoulders. I take that back. The women's shoulders. The women's shoulders. That's important, nafkamina, because sometimes you have shuls where the women's section is elevated. So I think some shuls, you know, maybe they have other rabbanim who give them heterim. But according to Moshe, I think that would be a little cheating. Because if when the women are standing, the mechitza barely gets to their waist, but when the men are sitting, it's over their head. I don't think that's going to serve so much of a function when you're standing. The mechitza I talked about where they gave a little pinch, that was exactly that kind of a mechitza. But Moshe held that it has to, again, if it's over the woman, a typical woman, if you can see her head above that, that's not the problem. It's not the seeing. But that's enough of a physical separation, Ramosha felt, that he thought that that would be preventing Kalas Rosh. Again, someone who's desperate to violate will find a way to violate. But as an Alpi Rov, that would solve the problem. If I'm not mistaken, the general assumption, I don't think Ramosha ever put this in a tshuva, but the general assumption in the name of Ramosha is that he felt that was 5 feet. I think the shear that they use for Ramosha is 60 inches. I'm sure many of you have been in shuls with shorter mechitzas, and I'm not saying Ramosha himself, Bidyevit, might have given a certain heterim, other Rabbanim might have given other heterim. I think Rav Soloveitchik was allowed a slightly shorter mechitza, not much lower, but I think he was a little bit more makel on how high a mechitza had to be. But that is a general rule. Let me go a little further, please, Shmuel, and see if we can take a question, okay? He says here, again, he explains. Again, it's all depending on your perspective. He's being very machmir, maybe from one perspective, but I'm telling you, he's being very makel from, if you're thinking about the Hungarian Rabbanim and their alternative tradition, and he alludes to that explicitly. Hare chazin and shamechitza eina mitzad iser histaklus kedekatavti le'el shezeh hare yadu gam mitchila, etc. He says, as we already proved from our interpretation of the Gemara in Sukkah, that the prohibition was never seeing men or women. Rather, it was all about being able to separate so there shouldn't be an issue. And he says here, another point which we'll, I think he's going to get back to in another paragraph if we have time to get to it. Stam gzuz tura ein ba mechitza. This is another point, a third or fourth point, whichever one we're up to. A big enough kamina, right? If you've been at shuls with mechitzas, with balconies, does the balcony need a mechitza? Does the balcony need a mechitza?
It has a rail.
All right, so the rail is so that they can pass the safety code. Because better than, worse than Kalas Rosh is women falling off the mechitza. I'm going to go on record for that, okay? I'm willing to make a stand. Taking a position. Dead women are worse than looking at women. I can say that confidently. So the rail is that. But what about the machit? What about the actual curtain? So in many shuls, I just, you know, I've been in shuls, you know, where they have a balcony without anything. And sometimes people are like, how could it be? I can stare right at her. Rav Moshe says, Mikra, then there's no problem. She's, you know, a story and a half above you. She's in the balcony. It's not going to be Kalas Rosh. And therefore, Moshe holds that that's permissible. There are shuls. I know even someone was telling me about, you know, in the new shul in Alon Shvut, where they have a balcony, but they built, you know, a little railing with some curtains. And for the most part, most of the curtains, someone told me, at least it used to be the curtains were usually closed, I think, a little bit. And then recently, it's been a little bit of a fight there. People open the curtains. Okay, this can be an issue. It sounds like a silly thing, but in certain shuls, the very issue of the curtains on the balcony can be an issue. But Rav Moshe is clear. Hold on, let me just get a little further on me. That he holds Ikra Din. Once you have that, it's not a problem. Let me just very quickly give you the highlights of the rest of this, because I'm obviously not going to get through all of it, but you have enough background now in the issues that if you want, you can see the rest of this inside. But on the bottom paragraph here on the front page, he alludes to an alternate possibility. Again, Rav Moshe is very rigorous and very, he's not hiding anything. Says Rav Moshe, if you want to know where the other idea comes from, it comes from a Rambam in the Parasha Mishnayos. The Rambam, in his commentary to the Mishnah, says explicitly that the problem with at the Simchat Beis Shoeva was his stakhlus. But Rav Moshe, since he's convinced that that's wrong, spends a good part of this paragraph turning over to the back page, which I only give you a snippet of, trying to reinterpret that Parasha Mishnayos to say that even the Rambam there was consistent with his view. But then, if you take a look here in the top paragraph, you see Rav Moshe says, and even if I'm wrong about the Rambam in the Parasha Mishnayos, if I'm kvetching a little bit too much, I'm trying to twist it a little bit too much, says Rav Moshe, it's okay, because the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, which is more authoritative halachically, in two places is explicit that the reason is Shelo Yeh Mu'uravin, Kedei Shelo Yitarvu Elu Im Elu. So if Rav Moshe is right, we can avoid, so to speak, the stira in the Rambam. But if we have to be forced to say there's a stira in the Rambam, so anyway, says Rav Moshe, I'm on the winning side, because it's 2-1, and it's 2 Mishnah Torah selections versus 1 Parasha Mishnayos. So Rav Moshe is convinced that the real issue is the Kalas Rosh. Now, we'll just mention briefly two more things, and then, again, we'll take any final questions if you'd like, and you can take a look at, again, the rest of this tshuva as well as the other tshuvas. Rav Moshe here discusses, he makes two more points. Let's see this next paragraph, which is all underlined. If that, as a general rule, we're going to assume would prevent Kalas Rosh, he thinks that's a sufficient mechitza. Hamachmirin lahagbia hamechitza ashlo yisaru gam rasheyan tavo aleihem bracha. But says Rav Moshe, this is where he is coming from. He says, but if someone wants to be machmir and make it even higher so you can't at all see the women, he says tavo la bracha. I don't think it's necessary mikra adin, but it's not a chumrah that he's against. Again, that might, again, these are complex, you have to know your tzibur, right? You say, well, if Moshe says there's nothing wrong with it, why shouldn't we be machmir? Well, maybe in your tzibur, in your community, that would be very offensive to women, that would make the women disinclined to come to shul. Okay, so if it's mikra din, if you held it was required, you're Hungarian, you have no choice, that's what the halacha requires. But if you hold like Rav Moshe, that it's mutter, it's not necessary, so Rav Moshe may think, if the women don't mind, if there's no downside, maybe he thinks that's a chumrah, that's a good thing. But he's not advocating that one has to be machmir that way. He's saying, if there's no downside, that is tovel abracha. But he adds, and this is very, very important, and this will be my last comment for the night, ubifrat sheharbei nashim b'medina zu, that's the US of A, einon nizharos b'kisei rosh, v'im nimsos gam prue rosh, kfar horizakim b'al rachashochan, etc., etc. Says Rav Moshe, and he, in the later paragraphs here and in the next tshuva, he discusses not only hair covering, but just the way the women dress when they come to shul. It talks about their arms being uncovered, etc. Says Rav Moshe, everything I'm saying is assuming that women come to shul dressed in a halakhically appropriate way. So then there's no problem with histaklus, even b'shas tefillah, which always is a higher standard. And then the only issue is kalas rosh, and if you want to be machmir, to have a higher mechitza, and that's good for your community, great. But says Rav Moshe, it's not so poshut if the women are going to come dressed inappropriately. He's make a little bit, if you have, again, this is like, you know, you have in certain shuls in certain generations, it was the doily generation. Right, that's becoming passe. A lot of communities now, and there were many women. When I was growing up, it was unheard of for a married woman, even if she didn't cover her hair, unheard of for her to come to shul without something on her head. I'm not saying she covered all her hair, but she, whether it was the doily or a hat, there was something. My wife told me recently that it's becoming more and more common in certain communities, unfortunately, that even that has gone by the wayside, and women just come to shul without any attempt. That, so on that point, that is a very sad commentary. Not in makom harich achshav, but on that point, Rav Moshe holds b'di'evit it's still okay, because the Aruch HaShulchan says Not that women don't have to cover their hair. They do. But on the halacha, that you're not supposed to say a bracha or daven in front of women's uncovered hair, so the Aruch HaShulchan already said, if it's common that women are uncovering their hair, so it still doesn't make it mutter, because everyone that flouts the halacha does not somehow, in some twisted way, make it now mutter to not keep the halacha. It's still usur. But says Aruch HaShulchan, and Rav Moshe endorses this, the added second point, that if a woman has uncovered hair, anyone, including her husband, can make a bracha. So the Aruch HaShulchan holds that does not apply in a case of a woman who generally never covers her hair. Because then the distraction/arousal factor is not there because the person's used to it. It doesn't make a mutter to do, but you lose the second problem of you can't make a bracha. So says Rav Moshe, if you're in a community where no one covers their hair anyway, and they come to shul with the doily or less, it's not good. Trust me, Rav Moshe wasn't happy. But that's not going to require me to change my mechitza. But he does say, I lost lack of exactly where that is, but it's somewhere here. Once or twice I put it on the sheet, where he says clearly that if they're going to not be dressed appropriately, and there's parts of their body, like their upper arms, which mi'ikra didn't have to be covered, and even that's not covered in shul, so that you maybe require mi'ikra didn't even according to Rav Moshe, higher mechitza. But assuming the women, you know, like they used to, understood that however they dress generally, which is a separate issue, but when you come to a shul, men and women should appreciate the higher level of kedusha that should be there and the conservative dress that should require, an appropriate dress. So then Rav Moshe holds mikra din, you need the mechitza. Again, he holds it's daraisa, even if the woman would be otherwise separate from the men. The mechitza itself is daraisa, not everyone agrees to that. I think Rav Soloveitchik, if I remember correctly, held just being separate was the daraisa. But the mechitza itself is darabana, Rav Moshe holds they're both daraisa. Ideally a mechitza, a balcony, because it's all about kalas rosh. But if necessary, you could have mechitza as long as it goes up covering the woman's shoulders and it prevents any free flow of discussion and let alone physical contact. Okay, I'm not running anywhere this second, although some of you may want to go to the chug. Anyone wants to leave? Shkayach for coming. Oh, there's no chug. Okay. I'm happy to stay a few more minutes for questions. Yeah.
Where's the precedent for the shoulder like being minimum?
I think that was just. I think it's a svara. It's a svara.
Or is that because of the clothing thing?
Again, I'm saying it's a svara. No, I'm saying, but it's a svara based on the issue that he doesn't think there's any issue with looking at a woman's face per se. That's not a place that has to be covered, notwithstanding the burqa ladies. But that's a twist. That's a twisted form of Judaism, which Moshe certainly did not ascribe to. So anything above the shoulders, ikra din, doesn't have to be covered, except for the hair, which he mentioned.
What would Moshe say about high enough?
So that's an excellent question. In one of the other tshuvas, which I didn't include here, he talks about if the higher part can be glass. And I can't remember what his maskana was. I didn't quote it here, so don't hold me to it. He talks about possibility of certain parts of it being glass. If it's so flimsy that it's not going to do anything. So again, I think as long it has to be some kind of a structure, that in Metzius it's going to be a clear separation of boundary and prevent the kalz rosh. Easily, freely passing things back and forth and the like. I think that would definitely be a problem if the mechitza still engenders or invites that type of interaction. There is supposed to be a separation. But if you can do it otherwise, it's ironic, but let me put it this way, you can be more makil in your mechitza the more machim you are in tznius. Right? So again, it's maybe ironic, and it's only ironic in the sense that the very communities which are most machmir in tznius are also most machmir in the mechitza. Okay, but that's better than being makel in both. You know, so I would say if I was in a shul in which there was a certain agitation for more liberal mechitza, I'm not saying this would work, but at least in my mind, hypothetically, I would want to turn that around and say, okay, let's play make a deal, you know. You know, if everyone wants to, you know, cover their hair and dress tzanua, you know, I can be much more liberal in my mechitza. Now, nothing here at all discusses, because I don't even know if it was possible in Moshe's day, but nor do I think there's any reason that he would have been against it, one-way glass and the like. In other words, there's no issue at all with women seeing. Again, I can't, maybe in Hasidic communities, but not. I'm saying, maybe they have makoros that I'm not aware of. I didn't mean that disrespectfully. I'm saying, but in halacha, and so that I'm familiar with, so in Moshe's writings, there's no reason whatsoever. And Adaraba, for things like Galila, mikra din, a woman, she has to see it. She can't fulfill the mitzvah. She can't see it to say, you know, v'zos ha-Torah. You have to be able to see the Torah to be able to do that. And there's no question, it makes sense, and I've heard this from, you know, all the holy women in my life, right? It's much harder to have kavana when you can't even see what's going on. So I happen to believe, getting off topic slightly, that certainly shul should be built in a way that maximize the experience, certainly the visual experience for the women. In my opinion, there's no question about that. In a community where that would make a difference to their avodas Hashem, then we should certainly try to do that. But it has to be at the same time faithful to the not only the din, but the reason, the tam, for the mechitza as well. And again, it's not ironic. It's just an important point. If you're dealing with halachic logic, not just, you know, the things that... The more, you know, reverential people are about the whole experience of davening, about kudush beis hakneses, and the way that reflects in their general behavior, comportment, and dress, then you actually may have, it's not going to be complete mutter, yisata mechitza, but it's going to be, I think, more flexible halachically to figure out the specifics. Yeah.
So you said that he defines somewhere else a shoulder length of 5 feet.
I think Baal Peh, I think people used to say, I think, I don't know if it's ever in any of the tshuvas, but I think the term he uses is ketefayim. I think he uses that consistently, but I think that was a known thing that a Moshe held 60 inches.
So if you're in, let's say, a school or something where people are shorter, does that make a difference or not?
I would think so, but I'm not positive. That's a good question. I don't know if there's anything in writing from Rav Moshe. And I would want to ask, you know, Talmidim of Rav Moshe if they knew of any cases like that, but logically, I would think yes. It couldn't be below... Saratocha, maybe. Right. Mini-me's.
Like, middle school or high
school. I understood your question. Logically, I think the answer is yes. Does he? I don't know if he discusses it. I can't be positive. But logically, I think the answer is yes. No. I mean, it's not a two... The halacha that you can't stare at someone to derive sexual pleasure, that applies, if I'm not mistaken, in both directions. And if there's a place that has to be covered, a woman can't see that either. But as a general rule, and now we're getting to, like, you know, maybe Rabbi Schreiber area or VOD topic area, which would be a good thing. I'm not poo-pooing it. But, you know, I think it suffices to say that Hashem made men and women differently. And one of the many things that he made us differently is, obviously, men's sexuality is much more visual than women's. I don't think there's a need to be ma'arich on that at the moment. I think it's just obvious. So therefore, the need to be, you know, there's no question the Gemara was, you know, to the extent that, again, Rav Moshe understands the Gemara is not being focused on the stachlus, but to the extent that there is a consideration, Rav Moshe clearly was describing, you know, not the women, you know, staring at the men, you know, and not being able to control themselves or focus, but in the other direction. But if it would happen, I think that would be just as bad in the other direction. Yes, Aaron.
So my question was kind of pretty much the same. I was just, like, wondering why, like, If he didn't have if Moshe didn't have a issue with his stock loop, then why wouldn't just a plain glass machitza be fine for both people to look? But you kind of answered that.
Yes, again, I want to be clarified. I think you understood this, but just to be clear, Rav Moshe was against Histoclus.
No,
I know what you mean. I understand. But the question is, what is the issue that we're so worried about that they made a takana of mechitza? That's the point. And Rav Moshe feels that it's not coming to prevent histoclus. Again, it's not, if you just, you know, want to climb over and stare anyway, of course, you know, a person could always do anything, you know, virtually. But that wasn't considered the pressing problem. The pressing problem was that if there, you know, between the, you said, the levity issue, but also specifically the expectation. Again, it's not just that mitosimcha b'shueva is more levity, but davening is the opposite context, which is that not because of the context of kedusha, we require better behavior.
So would people be fine, like, within his words, would there be people who would say, oh, there isn't this issue, so let's make see through mechitza for the men and still be within his?
I'm not sure. Again, I have to double check the one that I didn't include here about glass, because I don't think he says the whole thing's allowed. I think he talks about a certain higher part. I think, yes, I believe so. I believe so. Okay? Any other questions? Shekoyach. Thank you to the initiator and to the gabbai. Just call him the gobs for short from now. And Mirtz Hashem, same time, same place next week.